and welcome back. All right, we have a new topic tonight. Now, this is interesting. Some of you will remember the name Carrington, the Carrington incident. And I was 1890, I can't remember the year. I'll have to look it up. But it was a big deal. And I guess one way to think about it is kind of like a huge EMP that hits the whole planet. It did a lot of damage when it first manifested itself here over a century ago. And its potential right this minute is here upon us. The sun threw out an enormous amount of solar energy. Let's just call it that for the moment. And it's hitting the planet Earth right now. And here to talk to us about that is Rents Radio show host, brilliant man, Vincent Finelli. Welcome back, Vince. Thanks for being here and pointing this out to me. Tonight, right now.
Yeah, right now. Jeff, thank you. The storm was predicted to hit the East Coast around 8 p.m. Eastern time.
Uh-huh. That's 5 and, Pacific Coast time, all right?
Yeah, and it's here. And some of the news was really concerned about it. And then it seems like the front page news was displaced. This is a big deal. And let's put it in perspective. In 1859, which is what you were talking about, the Carrington event, that's the first recorded solar flare event. And we had telegraph lines running parallel with the railroad tracks so that
all over the country, that was the backbone of our communications, you bet.
Right. So train schedules could be updated. Signaling can be done from coast to coast. And so we had these wires stretched from telegraph pole to telegraph pole across the country. And it was a huge antenna, literally, because it was wires strung in the air, insulated from the ground. And the wires would drop down into railroad stations, telegraph stations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the sun had this massive eruption, solar energy, and it was hurling toward Earth, and it was picked up by these insulated wires, or a great big aerial, also known as an antenna. And the energy wants to go to ground. The ground, the Earth. And so it did. It got there as quickly as it could. It found it.
Mm-hmm.
Electricity is lazy. It wants to go to the ground the fastest, shortest way possible. And it did. And it literally set fires at the telegraph stations. There was that much energy because they were wood structures. That was in 1859.
Hard to believe. True.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. True. Yeah. You know, I say on the air, don't believe a word I say. Look it up, verify it, and for yourself. In 1872, there was another one. There was another strong solar storm.
Vince, a question, please. Hold on.
Mm-hmm.
Did in 1859, did many people even understand what the hell had just happened?
Did they even understand
solar flare? I don't think so either.
I don't think so. You know, we were just learning about electricity back then. You know, we didn't have
Tesla wasn't even here yet. Yeah.
Right. We didn't have electric light bulbs. It wasn't invented yet. It wasn't popular. There was no radio, so to speak. You know, those were the early days of experimenting with trying to send signals through the air. Barely scratching the surface. Nothing was even recorded about that. 1872, there was another solar storm, a strong one. Not a lot of information about that. 1921, there was another one. Less severe, but back then, there was radio. And there were widespread radio disruptions. So there was, radio was working fine, and there were tube-powered radios, not transistors, not integrated circuits, tube-powered. And they are pretty darn immune from a lot of electromagnetic radiation. But there were disruptions in radio signals. I mean, the mm-hmm. sun is pretty powerful compared to Earth here. And then that was in 1921. In 1989, there was another one. and it was a geomagnetic storm, and it literally disrupted electricity in Quebec, Canada. Large areas were disrupted, and you might remember that people were stuck in elevators because the power grid
just went down.
Yes,
I remember that now. Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And then again, in 2003, the power was knocked out in Sweden, and transformers were cooked or failed. I'm talking about power transformers that mm-hmm. distribute electricity in South Africa. So these things have been happening, and this one, the one that happened today, the plasma is about, well, depending on what you read and who you read, somewhere between 16 times and 17 times the diameter of the Earth. So the Earth that's facing the sun is getting it the most, but it kind of wraps around the Earth a little bit. So the question is, and I don't know the answer to this at the moment, but what I do know is electronics have gotten more and more sophisticated. More circuitry is in smaller packages. The traces of the paths of the, we'll call it wiring, of integrated circuits has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller to the point where we can't make it any smaller. So we've packed millions of transistors into a small integrated circuit called a central processor in a cell phone. Yeah. So if you overpower these tiny circuits, they mm-hmm. just can't handle the current, and they mm-hmm. cook, and they melt down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's
when you're looking at this, did you talk about this on USA Prepares today on the program?
Yeah, we did. We did tour it. In the last. We have four segments. So hour number one has segment one and segment two. Hour number two has segment one and segment two. So we talked about it on the second segment of the second hour. And mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that we had enough information, not to frighten people unnecessarily, but enough. I wanted to be certain of what I was saying before we might have caused a mild panic. And there's no need to panic, but there is a need to protect your equipment. And we can talk about that if you'd like.
Yeah. No, this is fascinating. 1859 as opposed to 2024. The whole world is it's not different. It's not even the same planet, basically, with all the microcircuitry. You're right. They're so delicate, they can be overamped and just fried. They can melt, they can cook, whatever descriptor you want to use. But this this potentially being 15 to 17 times as large as the Earth, talk about a kill shot potential. It's there. This is EMP potential kill shot stuff.
Well, here's one way of looking at it. Let's say you want to buy computer memory for your computer. Let's say you want to upgrade it.
Right, right.
And you ordered it on the Internet. It would arrive in a anti-static Mylar bag, kind of like a silvery bag. And it's not like they ran out of Ziploc bags. It's mm-hmm. that they put the sellers and the manufacturers put these memory circuit strips in packages that are resistant to static electricity. Because literally, if you had an Angora sweater or a wool sweater on and you touched one of these and there was static that jumped off your finger onto the contacts of a memory chip, you could blow the memory chip. The same with a video card, the same with a central processing unit. And we had a company that manufactured computers back in the 90s all the way through to 2004 or 5 in mm-hmm. Virginia. And when I handled memory, central processors, video cards, you know, the circuitry, the inner circuitry, the hardware of a computer, I would wear a strap. And it'd be kind of like a bracelet attached to a metallic coiled cord, attached to an alligator clip, grounded to a large grounding surface, so that the potential of me walking around, working on the bench, I'd be at the same static potential.
Right.
Got it.
As the bench, yeah. as the computer equipment. So I wouldn't blow the equipment while I was trying to fix it. So that's how sensitive some of these circuits are. But they're everywhere. I mean, if you have a stove, it's got a display. That's got a control board with a computer processor. If you have a dishwasher that has LEDs that let you know which cycle, or a display that gives you more information than that, or a washer or a dryer with a display, you've got computer circuitry. And those circuits are really susceptible to surges and electromagnetic pulses, static electricity, and the like. So this is a pretty big deal, and we can do some simple things to protect your equipment. I don't think we have to be too worried about us, and I don't think we have to be worried about two animals, unless our animals are dependent on the electronics to keep them alive and happy, like cows. Like if you have cows fenced in with an electric fence, as we do here at our farm, we have a fence controller, and it's got a couple miles of electric fence tape. It's all connected to what's called a fence charger. Well, that electric fence tape, it's about a half inch wide. It's white. It's got silver six strands of stainless steel wire to conduct electricity, and it's strung on insulated posts. That is an antenna a couple miles long. And when a large plasma ball is hurled at us, it hops on that just like it hops on the power wires, just like it hops on the telephone wires and telegraph wires, and it can blow the fence charger. Then the animals can get out. So there are a lot of things that can happen that we would prefer didn't happen. So
Vince,
we can protect ourselves.
Question.
Yeah.
Please. What in the house, what in the lives of most people are not carrying chips, microcircuits, etc.? How far do you have to look before you find something that would not be affected by a massive EMP or a solar flare like this, which is very similar, that could be knocked out? What in the house is old-fashioned, unless you've got some old-fashioned things? I mean, seriously, go ahead.
It's funny you say that. I kind of addressed that today, and I said, I'm in the studio. And I've got a mixer. It's probably 15 to 20 years old. I've got the newest computer here. It's 10 years old. Other computers are probably 15 or more years old. But I've got a stereo system that I play the signal, the feed, during the breaks through a pair of speakers. And that was built around 1974. So that's 50 years old. But it's still transistorized. So everything in the studio that I'm using to communicate with you on this broadcast involves solid-state electronics, everything. And even the mixer I'm using is an old mixer. It's analog, but it's still solid-state. So the only thing that's not really powered is the microphone. That's pretty much it. Bottom line is, Jeff, we use sometimes smart devices to make our coffee. We don't know how to do that anymore, so we have a coffee maker that plugs into a 120-volt receptacle, but it's got a timer. It's got a soft-touch switch that is controlling a processor. So even at a $24.99 Walmart coffee maker, Black & Decker, for example, is still solid-state, still microelectronics. So that's susceptible as well. You're absolutely right. Virtually nothing. I don't think a person could leave whatever room a person is in right now. I don't think they could leave that room without finding several devices that are powered by solid-state electronics.
The automobile industry, you think about cars, you have to go back to the late 1960s. That's when they first began to put computer chips to monitor and control fuel injection systems, for example. You need to go back to a 60s or 50s or 40s car with a carburetor and nothing electronic to speak of if you want to get around anymore. But it doesn't matter because you won't be able to get fuel anyway. I mean, if they take everything out, go ahead.
That's an excellent point. I just came back from Sam's Club, and I had a meeting right after the broadcast this morning. I had a meeting with the family. Our son and my wife and I work this farm. It's a cattle farm.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, let's take some time right now. And what do we need? What would it be terrible for our farm if we didn't have it? What would that be? And so some of those things are, well, if we have to heat the house or heat hot water, I mean, it's hot outside, so it's just heating hot water. We cut tree limbs that have fallen, mm-hmm. but we can't cut any of them without it. Gasoline for the chainsaw. Gasoline's a big deal for a farm.
Yeah,
you don't need a lot for a chainsaw, but if you have none, the chainsaw won't work. So we thought, okay. So we poured the gasoline that we had in those 5-gallon gas cans into the equipment that we have, and then we went put all those gas cans in the pickup truck and went to Sam's Club and topped them all off. We also got 50 pounds of flour because we make bread. And the dogs here, we have 6 dogs, they love these treats that I make. And it's just bread that I cut up into cubes and dry out, and it's equivalent of biscuits. So they love that. And it also stretches their dog food. So
nice.
2 bags of 25 pounds. Yeah. And so, but we bought a whole bunch of other things too, like canned chicken. Sam's Club has that. We bought 2 cases of oil for cooking, 2 cases. And the reason is because it certainly is not going to go down in price. That's number one. We're making a 120-mile round trip to the big city, Springfield, Missouri, and we're going to use it. We'll use it sooner or later. We'll use all of these things. The bottom line is, what if we couldn't get it? And we have campers that come to our campground, and I bake every one of them a loaf of bread, a 1.5-pound loaf of bread. And it's kind of like a tradition because they come here, and sometimes they forget that they're hungry, and they get here, and so now they have a loaf of, you know, hot bread. So
How nice. Well, that's wonderful.
You know,
simple, but really nice.
Well, it's just the golden rule. It's, you know, how would I want to be treated?
Yes, sir.
That's what we do. But the bottom line is, what would you like to be without, or what would you not like to be without? So if you think about that,
mm-hmm.
water. Water's a big thing. So while we were out, Mrs. Finelli was filling up cleaned 2-liter bottles. You know, we save them. We don't drink very much.
Glass bottles. But,
well, these happen to be plastic or mm-hmm. Distilled water bottles. We have a solar system, so it drinks maybe 100 gallons of distilled water a year. So we save the boxes and put mm-hmm. the caps on them. And then we, you know, so we've got 100 jugs at least at any one point in time. So we have water, and we have a water well. But, you could die without water in 3 days. So that's a really important thing. So is it a certainty that we're going to lose a microwave oven or a dishwasher, our washing machine and our dryer? We don't use a dryer, but we have one. It's got a mechanical timer. That's not going to fail because of an electromagnetic pulse or a solar storm. But the stove has it's 19 years old. It has a digital control that could blow. And literally all of these electronic devices that we have in our house, and everybody has in their house just as well,
right.
They're all plugged into the grid. Now, and the grid is all connected to the power lines. And how long are these power lines? Well, in the United States, there's 5 million miles of electric wires. 5 million
all
miles.
Antennas.
It's like one big antenna. And it mm-hmm. and all these, you know, in a house, washer, dryer, refrigerator, freezer, computer, television, DVD player, whatever the devices are, they're all connected to each other through the breaker panel. Every device is literally directly connected to all the others. Even though they're individual circuit breakers, they're all connected. So mm-hmm. if a pulse comes over the power lines into your house, it is attached to all of your devices that are plugged in, all of them.
Instantaneous access. Yep.
186,000 miles per second. That's how fast it goes. That's the speed of light, and that's the speed of electricity. You're absolutely right. It's instantaneous. And if you see it coming, it's too late. If you see it coming, it already happened. You can't react that fast. And no, a surge protector will not protect against this kind of magnitude.
That's not something that big. No, I don't know.
No. So there's this feeling that people have that, you know, they've got a surge protector and everything's going to be just fine. That's absolutely not true.
No. Okay for lightning, maybe. I don't know. If you are interested in what we're talking about, and I hope all of you are, I expect most all of you are, USA Prepares is the radio program that Vincent created. And he has put together something that I am very proud to have on the network. This is practical nuts and bolts knowledge of survival dimensions that you will not hear anywhere else. And it's presented in such a fascinating way. This is something you want to listen to every day if you get a chance. It's that interesting, that important too. So again, this is a big deal, this solar thing. If you look up Carrington event, solar storms can be dangerous to our technologies, says the Google search reply. If Earth happens to be in the path of a CME, the charged particles can slam into our atmosphere, disrupt satellites in orbit, and even cause them to fail and bathe high-flying airplanes with radiation. They can disrupt telecommunications and navigation systems as well. What they're saying in those two or three sentences is that everything stops. Airplanes could potentially fall out of the sky if they get their microcircuits fried. They just fall. They're dead weight. This is really is a big deal. I'm not saying you need to worry right now. Don't run into the bed and hide. But be aware of potentials. And if there's a nuclear war, many people feel without question that the first round will be an EMP attack or two or three to bring the country all of a sudden back to the 1800s. And what are they going to do? How much of the military's microcircuitry is actually protected? Not a whole lot. The top-end gear would be, as they'd try, but could the Carrington event, or a Carrington event, override those protective measures and fry the military's microcircuitry? I think in many cases it could. That includes ICBMs, rockets, surface-to-air missiles, you name it. Nuclear submarines, all of their microcircuits could be gone. Think about this. It's really something big, 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 big.
Now, Jeff, you mentioned satellites. I got a chance to see a satellite around 1981 that was under construction at Ford Aerospace. I actually went into the same room as this satellite. Yeah.
Did you have to wear whites and masks and all that?
Yeah. Yeah. It was like going into an operating room. As a matter of fact, we started a company manufacturing satellite communications receivers, C-band receivers, back in 1980. And one of the instructors who's on the air with me, Bert Bertonis, was one of those guys who's a partner of mine in the satellite communications equipment business. We were manufacturing, designing, and so forth. But we had two advisory groups. One was a business advisory group and one was a technical advisory group. And there was a senior VP for Ford Aerospace. He said, "We're building a satellite. You guys want to come see it?" We're like 27 years old. And So to get in to see this satellite, we had to go through, each one of us one at a time, through what was like a phone booth at the time. A payphone, and it had glass walls and a door. And you'd go in there, and then you were inspected, and you couldn't get out unless they let you out. It's like you walk in there and stop. And then if they wanted to let you out, they'd let you out. If you're going to be arrested, you weren't going anywhere anyway. So they would inspect you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then they'd let you into this room where Intelsat 5, the first one, was being built. And so we actually saw that. And so I learned a little bit about how satellites work. And here's the interesting thing about it. A satellite is put into orbit with a large rocket. And then the rocket falls down to Earth, and I guess the plan is to have it splash down, you know, not in Brooklyn, but in the ocean.
Right.
So it splashes down, but the satellite stays up there until it runs out of gas. Now, what am I talking about? So a satellite is put into a box. We'll call it, like, it's a cube. And they'll say, okay, the satellite can drift a little to the left, a little up, a little down, a little to the right, a little to the front, a little to the back, but it's got to stay in this box. And if it gets outside of this box, it can crash into another satellite. If it goes too high, we can lose it into outer space. If it goes too low, it'll fall to the ground. So it has to stay in this box. So they have like a compressed gas. And it has a jets that kind of gently nudge the satellite back into the box if it starts to drift toward the edge of a box that it's in.
That's its orbit you're talking about. The box is the orbit.
Keeps it in orbit, right? And so with a geomagnetic storm or a solar flare or solar energy, if that overpowers the ability for the ground to communicate with the satellite and say, okay, go a little up, a little higher, okay, that's good, or move to the left or right, if we lose the ability to communicate with the satellite for a long enough period, the satellite will either drift out into space or fall down to the Earth. So this is a pretty big deal. So, you know, I don't think they, whoever they are, really want us to know that these satellites can all fall down if we lose communications with them. Now, I'm not saying we are going to lose communications with them, but if we did, we couldn't control them, and they will probably fall down, most of them, or crash into the others. And then there's this theory that once one or more satellites crash into each other, and it'll be like hand grenades, and these little fragments will be flying around at really high speeds. They'll be small, but they'll be flying around at such high speeds that they will take out other satellites, which will take out other satellites. It'll be a domino effect, and it will be uninhabitable in low Earth orbit from all the crashes that have resulted from maybe one or two or three satellites banging into each other.
I got it. Fascinating. Wow. Well, let's see here. I wonder what they're saying here. This is nuts. I'm trying to find out how many satellites are currently in orbit around the Earth. Most of them are in low Earth orbit. As of December 31st, let's say as of January 1, 2023, there are, according to this return on Google, 6,718 operational satellites in Earth orbit. Now, if you keep looking, what's interesting, who has the most satellites in space? And you just heard there's 6,700 operational satellites a year and 4 months ago. It says here, which country owns the most satellites in orbit? The USA leads the count with a staggering 11,655 satellites in orbit. Well, how does that stack up with 6,700? So there's seems to be a bit of disinformation or misinformation here. You can't just look it up and trust it anyhow. You've got to be careful.
And
which
they
country
say
has
that,
the most satellites in space? Yeah.
And they say that US. Elon Musk wants to put four times more than that out there within, I think, within a year or so, maybe 2 years. Very short amount of time, four times as many satellites. So we're talking almost, the number I read was about 40,000.
Right. No, it's huge. Yeah, you're correct. He's doing very well with Starlink. That might be his best acquisition, although I'm not sure it was his, but he's a made man, as we know. But that's a lot of stuff. You can get Starlink for your home. You can get it on the farm. You can also get it if you are interested in traveling around in an RV or a trailer. You can get Starlink that way too. And he's got something big going. Now, if this cascade damage would occur among satellites, with, it would be like an asteroid belt of tiny particles that are deadly to satellites all around the low Earth orbit of our planet. And if you put a new one up there, it would be shredded by these little guys that are traveling plenty fast to do real havoc. Am I on page with this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And literally, what goes up really comes down. And the guys that put these satellites up really don't say, well, they could land in houses. And there have been reports where chunks of the International Space Station, you know, they ejected some equipment they didn't need. It fell through a guy's roof. He wasn't home. Boom! It was a loud noise. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, I put on my website years ago that I posted that there's a $1,000 fine for people throwing litter on our farm because a cow stepped on bottles and, you know, they cut their legs. And it's
Come
just
on.
Annoying.
This is happening on your farm? Really?
Well, it used to.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't anymore.
Understood.
But I did put that there would be $1 million fine if space junk landed on our farm. Now, why would I do that? Because I know what would happen. If space junk landed on our farm, the government, the feds would say, that is government property. And by the way, it's radioactive because we have a nuclear reactor in that satellite, and it's radioactive, so you're going to have to leave your farm. Mm. So I figured, okay, if this happens, I need to be compensated. So
sure
I posted that it's $1 million fine for dropping space junk on our farm.
Mm-hmm.
Probably shouldn't have said that, right?
No, it's fine. There are very few people who think about these things, or let alone know about them. They didn't know about this CME today. I don't think any company is doing anything to really insulate or protect their microcircuitry that they put into vehicles, so forth, or any appliance, any consumer good. They just put them in. There's no effort to protect, not that I've ever heard.
We used to.
I'm trying to get my 1950 Ford station wagon running. That's what I'm going to
really?
Drive.
You have a 54?
50-50.
Oh,
1950 Ford Woody station
great.
Wagon. Yeah.
Really? That sounds great.
Yeah.
So it's
yeah,
got
it
an inline six.
No, longer. I put a brand new crate GM motor in it, but it's carbureted. So
okay.
Nothing in the engine that can get fried. This is simple.
It sounds good to me. You know, we have a couple old cars in one of our barns.
Love them.
And
barn find. Find at Vince's farm. Okay.
But these aren't really. Yeah. You know, these don't have 4 inches of dust on them. These actually some of them actually work, but one of them actually two of them are 1968 vehicles. And mm-hmm. they have a solid-state alternator regulator. So currently the alternators have built-in regulators. But this had an external one built by Motorola. But back in 1968, it was solid-state. So it had components that could be taken out. They're pretty rugged, but theoretically they could be taken out. So you might have to go back before that or go with a fully mechanical diesel engine. So, and that's possible too. And you know, that's something to think about. How long does gasoline store? I don't know.
They have, you've probably talked about this on the program many times. They have fuel stabilizer. In fact, mm-hmm. one of them is called Stable or something. Mm-hmm. So you can put that in your gas and make it last longer. 1976, General Motors and Motorola teamed up to create a custom microcomputer for use in their vehicles. 1976, Intel first enters the market for automotive engine controller chips, and in 1977, Oldsmobile introduces a digital computer to control ignition timing in their Toronado model cars. So you got to go back in the early 70s, it looks like, try to be sure if you're trying to find a vehicle that you can rely on in crazy times. That's what I would consider. You know, I remember my first car. You remember your first car?
Sure.
No, actually, it wasn't my first car. It was one of the first few. It was a 1953 Ford, two-door, three-speed on the column with overdrive. Wonderful car. Flathead V8. I think it was still a flathead. Anyway, those cars were just built to last. Heavier gauge body sheet metal than they use now. I don't know what they used back then. I think it's 16, maybe 14 gauge. They're using 18 gauge now. That's why it just crumples up. No resistance.
My first vehicle was 1 year newer than yours. It was a 1954 Willys Jeep. And what a great little four-wheel drive Jeep. But you know, you're talking about thin steel. We have an automotive shop here. And there's a car on the lift right now that came in. It's a Ford Escape 2005 unibody. Mm-hmm. And in the back, in the back compartment, the area you put your groceries, there's plastic wheel liners. And there's holes in the wheel liners where the shock absorbers poked right through because the sheet metal that supports the rear of the vehicles rusted through. And the vehicle fell on the rear axle and suspension.
Crazy.
It's that thin. It's so bad, there's a recall from 2001, 2, 3, and 4. But this is a 2005, and Ford isn't admitting that this one is also got the same problems. But their kits, they're so problematic that you can buy a kit to repair the hole and re-support the shock strut.
Funny. Sickening. Funny. If you're around, any of you are around, if you go to a classic car show or something, wrap on the fenders of your vehicle that took you to that show, and then just gently tap on the fender of some of the cars in the show, 50s, 40s. You'll be shocked at the difference in the sheet metal. People just don't think about that. I had to put all new, you'll appreciate this, this Ford 1950 Ford Woody came from Massachusetts, and they had carpet on the floor, and I figured it was okay, and they said it was okay. But when I looked under the carpet, all I could see was rust and holes. So I had to cut out the entire floorboard of the car. Just the frame rails were left. It was all rusted. Frame was fine. And we put in new sheet metal for the floor. And I used 14-gauge steel. And the car is better than new. It's solid as a rock now. But it people don't understand that they're driving around in this cheapest junk. Ugh, it's bad.
Have you had a chance to cut a piece of body panel off and look at the thickness of the paint versus the thickness of the steel of a new car?
I have not done that.
They're about the same thickness.
Oh, my.
Seriously. Yeah. So when you wrap on it and you think, well, maybe it's a little thinner. Well, half of that is the paint.
Good point, Vincent. Wow.
It's absolutely true. So people are driving these vehicles that are really, really dangerous from a lot of perspectives. But,
well,
you know, Jeff, we're talking about
30 miles an hour. They're done, most of them. Go ahead.
Well, okay. So if you look at any car in a relatively new car in a parking lot, you'll see, or driving down the highway, you'll see dings and dents, but it's like crumpled like aluminum foil would crumple. And the old cars didn't do that. You have to ask yourself, how did that happen? Was it a shopping cart that dented that car that much?
No kidding.
What was it? Yeah. Uh-huh. What was it that did that much damage? Because the old cars did not dent like that. Because the metal was so much thicker. We're talking about protecting equipment. And here's an interesting tip. Many years ago in the 80s, I was a computer jockey for banks. And I was designing computer systems. And I wanted to protect the systems that I built. So I called a company called American Power Conversion, and known as APC today. They make great uninterruptible power systems. They make surge protection equipment. And so my question was this. So they were a brand new company back then. They just started, and I thought, I really like them because I got a chance to talk to some of their engineers. I said, here's my question. If I have a circuit, an electric circuit, that has, let's say, 10 receptacles on it, and that could be like a house. Let's say it's a living room and you have 10 outlet receptacles. And you plug in the surge protector at the first one, closest to the breaker panel. Just plug it in and leave it there. But you know, turn the switch on and just leave it plugged in. Does it protect any of the equipment plugged into outlet number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, all the way up to 10? Does it do any good? That was my question. Or does the protection only apply to the devices plugged into the surge protection strip? The answer was quite astonishing. They said, we don't know, but we're going to find out. We're going to test it, and we'll call you back. And they did. And they said, okay, so the surge protector is rated at 330 volts. So 331 volts and higher gets stopped by the surge protection equipment. So on 120-volt outlet, 120 volts, all the way up to 330 pass through the surge protector. 331 and higher gets stopped. But if you plug a surge protector in, theirs, American Power Conversion, plug it into a receptacle, receptacle number one, and you want to know if you're protected for the other outlets that don't have a surge protector plugged in, but they're on the same circuit breaker, it will protect them almost as well. But it'll let 75 volts more through. So it'll protect 330 plus 75. That's the answer. So tonight, if those who are willing to stay up a little later and they've got a couple surge protectors in the basement and that aren't being used, get them out and plug them in to the receptacles closest to the breaker panel. Because electricity is lazy, and all you have to do is plug a couple of them in onto leg one and leg two of your breaker panel. And because there's two sides of a 240-volt electric panel, and the odds are if you plug two of them in, you're probably going to cover both legs, L1 and L2, and just turn them on. Plug it in and turn them on. Now, that will help somewhat, but for complete protection, my suggestion is consider shutting off the main breaker. Now, at night, you don't have to worry about it as much, but tomorrow morning when the sun starts rising, and this is going to be with us, this coronal mass ejection, this plasma is going to be with us for a couple days. It's going to be through the weekend. So Saturday, Sunday, it might ride into Monday as well. So I think the best advice that we could deploy right now would be plug some surge protectors in, unplug any equipment that you absolutely don't want to lose, unplug any equipment you don't want to lose, and shut off the breakers. But under normal circumstances, just having those extra surge protectors that aren't being used, plug them in and turn them on. They don't do any good if you don't turn them on. You have to turn the on switch on. It does no good if you plug it in and don't turn the on switch on. What do you think?
It's a.
Did I lose? Oh, I swear.
No, no, we're
you.
Here. Very. I'm just processing this. Unplug. Don't. Yeah. Unplug. That's the key. You have
it
to
is.
Disconnect. You really do. And a lot of people don't want to be bothered. Well, Vince just summed it up perfectly. Any piece of equipment you don't want to lose, unplug it. It's not so hard. You're totally
antenna,
safe that way.
It's because the antenna is 5 million miles long.
Right.
Right.
That's all true.
So, and even that 6-foot power cord that comes out of the back of, I don't know, the DVD player, the TV, that's still an antenna. But I don't think it's big enough to gather enough of this massive amount of solar energy to blow the equipment. But you know what? If you have a house and you have typical wiring, you have thousands of feet of wire in your house already. So,
yes,
and it's
yes.
all connected. It's all
yes,
connected
it
to each other. So a couple thousand feet of wire, that's, you know, even though it's in the house, even though it's in the walls, it's still insulated from the ground.
It doesn't care about walls. EMF goes right through it.
Mm-hmm.
You're living inside of not a Faraday cage, but the opposite of a Faraday. You're living inside of an electrical box, it's messing with you on many different levels. But not to the extent that most people will notice and complain. I think a lot of people actually do get sick, and they go to the doctor, and doctors never think of these kinds of things. Well, is there a smart meter on your house? Where is it located vis-a-vis your bedroom? Is there a digital clock radio on your nightstand right next to the head of your bed where your head on the pillow is located? They don't ask these things. And by the way, those so-called discharge mats with the copper wiring in them that you put on your bed that have a cable coming out of one end and you plug it into the ground of a wall receptacle, they don't use those. They're not safe. You literally become part of the circuit rather than be discharged.
Well, they reflect. They reflect.
Yeah, go ahead.
They reflect energy from, from the walls, from satellites, from microwave satellites.
Yes,
it takes the energy, you absorb the energy through your body, let's say from overhead, but then those screens, if they're metallic, they reflect it right back. So it becomes not quite like a parabolic reflector antenna, but kind of like that.
Right. It's true. People know little. This all should be taught in high school, like how to balance a checkbook. Don't do that anymore.
Here's an interesting thing about electricity. So if you have, let's say, a typical bedroom. Let's say the bedroom has an outlet. Let's say just four outlets, north, south, mm-hmm. east, and west. And it's on one circuit. So one circuit breaker powers the whole bedroom. And if there's a certainty that one of those wires, AC, 60 cycles, is right behind the headboard, 8 hours a day, right by your head. No question
yes.
about it.
Oh, yes.
But is it active? And the answer is maybe. So how is it active? Well, if you have, let's say, a nightlight plugged in. If you have a nightlight plugged in to the end of that, the last outlet, it's now energized.
Right.
And
right.
60 cycle electricity is coming out through the air.
I know.
If you don't have any outlets using electricity, there is none. So it depends on whether you're using electricity on that. And so I just picked a nightlight because it could be an LED nightlight of 1 watt. But that 1 watt causes the 60 cycle electricity to go through the wire.
Well said. If you look on the right side of the homepage, I will send this to you, Vince. It's a very good video. And the title is, it's actually the fourth story down in the Jeff and Erica section. The very serious, fully documented risks of grounding products and earthing to discharge accumulated electrical fields from the body. You need to hear what this man has to say. He's a real pro. It's fascinating. I'll send it along. Vincent, thank you for that. As always, USA Prepares is one of the most unique programs on radio anywhere in the world. And we're very happy to have Vincent with us. So check it out. I think you'll fall in love with it. Intellectually, it's got it all. It's there. Mechanically speaking, with common sense DIY sorts of information, nothing can touch it. It's that good. Thank you, my friend, for everything.
Thank you, Jeff.
Okay, good night. Vincent Finelli. All right, that's our program for you, and we'll be back Monday, another weekend here. Think about preparing, and do listen to USA Prepares on the network. I think you'll really like it. It's addicting, the information. It's so unique, and you won't find it anywhere else. So enjoy and learn, and we'll talk Monday. Take care.